listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, we find out about a new history project that's capturing the stories of Milwaukeeans who marched in the open housing marches 50 years ago. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Wisconsin high schoolers finished up a four-day march to Janesville this week to advocate for stricter gun control laws. A new law in Wisconsin changes where sex offenders can live after they leave prison. And one paper mill in the Fox Valley is coming back to life after shutting down last year. Robert Menser is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Rob, great to have you back.
Hey, thanks.
So let's start with the student gun march. A couple weeks ago, we saw high school students around the country demonstrating for stricter gun laws in the wake of the Parkland, Florida school shooting. One group of students in Wisconsin took things a step further this week. Tell us about the 50 Miles More march.
Sure. 50 Miles More was a group of, it turned out to be about 40 or 50 students who marched from Madison to Janesville to sort of extend that that March for Our Lives protest. They said that they were inspired by Martin Luther King Jr.'s march from Selma to Montgomery, which was about 50 miles or so, and they're calling on other groups, teens, students to do the same in their state.
Let's take a listen to Brendan Fardella, one of the students, talking about why they took the march.
We want to keep it going, want to keep it in the news cycle, keep people empowered and passionate for as long as we can until there's common sense gun reform, or until we get to November and all of these politicians are up for re-election and we vote them out if they don't do anything.
Rob, in terms of getting that news attention that Brendan Fardella talked about and making their movement visible, do you think the march was a success?
You know, I think a wild success, right? And it's a common thread with the responses to the Parkland school shootings. Just how savvy the activists have been about keeping their message central in the media. I mean, it's interesting on its own. They generated tons of social media response and traditional media coverage, but they have a nice website. They had Twitter feeds and Instagram feeds, and sort of gave people a sense that they were able to participate or support these kids if they connected with their message.
So they marched from Madison to Janesville. Why was Janesville their destination?
Sure. Well, I mean, there's this fellow in Janesville who holds a little bit of political power named Paul Ryan. So they wanted to make the point by ending their march in near the office of the Speaker of the House, who is Paul Ryan, and to make the case that politicians need to do more on gun control.
And what demands were the students making specifically?
Yeah, they have a list of specific policies. They want bans on bump stocks, the devices that allow a rifle to fire many more rounds more quickly. They want legal purchasing age for guns to be raised to 21 from 18. They want background checks on all gun sales. And they say they want a ban on military-style weapons and weapons of war, which, of course, those terms themselves are the subjects of debate.
Well, Rob, let's move on to another topic, one that we touched on a few weeks ago. We talked about some backlash over a sex offender being housed in a remote area of Forest County. That individual wasn't living in Forest County prior to his incarceration. Now there's a bipartisan bill signed into law by the governor that changes housing for sexual offenders. What would this bill do?
Sure. So this is a little complicated, but to understand it, so basically under Wisconsin has a class of offenders known as sexually violent people. This is a legal distinction. A judge can declare someone to be a sexually violent person, and that allows the state to hold that offender even after their prison terms expire. So this is, this is meant to protect the public from these offenders, but obviously under the Constitution, the state can't just lock people up and throw away the key, even if they are very bad people. So these offenders have a right to have their cases reviewed by the state, and when the cases are reviewed, sometimes if they meet certain conditions, they can be released. Then the state has to figure out where to put them. So as you might imagine, nobody wants these offenders moving in next door to them. So this has created problems when judges, who up to now were allowed to send someone anywhere in the state that meets these certain conditions, now under the new law, those offenders will need to stay in their close near their home county. They can't just be sent somewhere that then has to deal with these people.
Well, and one of the issues that often comes up talking about sex offender relocation is distance requirements. They are not allowed to live within a certain distance of things like schools and playgrounds and libraries, other places where children congregate. Was there any part of this bill that deals with that requirement?
There was, and then there wasn't. Under the bill that passed, it would have waived the requirement that these placements be 1,500 feet away from any school or park or nursing home or some. There are some other requirements even beyond that. I haven't actually mapped it out, but the authors of the bill and people who, as you refer to. These requirements can make it literally impossible to place these offenders in a place that has any kind of population density at all. So that's what was in the bill. However, Governor Scott Walker, when he signed the bill, vetoed that provision of what now is the law. So his statement was basically the same reason for the requirement to exist in the first place, to try to protect people from these offenders. But the problem is that he may have created a situation where the law requires judges to place offenders in areas where, also by this law, there are literally no places that can take them.
We're talking with Rob Menser right now. He's a news editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin with us for our weekly look at the top news stories in the state. And Rob, we've been talking about the paper industry quite a bit lately, focusing on the closing of a couple Kimberly-Clark plants in the Fox Valley and the industry's downturn as a whole. But there's some good news coming out of the village of Combined Locks that is bucking that trend. What's going on there?
Yeah, I think I have never seen this before, and who knows if it will last, but it's very interesting. The Appleton coated paper mill there, Combined Locks basically is in the Appleton area, went into receivership in the fall and it closed, and 600 people lost their jobs. Then the plant was bought by a used machine dealer, and often what happens, or at least what has happened at other paper mills, is that the new owner comes in and scraps the equipment and sells it for parts, and then the site is empty and no one knows what to do with it. But instead of that happening, in the first months of this year, this plant has started making paper again, and they've called back more than 200 people back to their jobs so far.
Are they doing the same kind of products that they had been doing before it was shuttered?
So they had been specializing in printer paper, which is not the specialty that you want to have in the paper industry right now. And what the owners say and the union representatives that we spoke with said is that the new owner has made significant investments to make a switch to switch over to making a corrugated cardboard, which is the paper industry that you want to be in right now.
And briefly, what kind of reaction are you hearing in the area from residents and from other businesses?
I mean, fairly ecstatic, right? The Outagamie County Executive Tom Nelson said it was nothing short of a miracle. And, so by the end, the company says they expect to have about 300 people working at the mill. That is still a lot less than 600 people who lost their jobs. But compared to nothing or just this place sitting empty, it's a large improvement.
Well, Rob, before we let you go, I want to talk a little bit about Brittany Wagner. She's the new Ms. America, not Miss America, Ms. America. And she recently moved to Wisconsin. What brought her here?
Yeah. Welcome, Ms. America. She lives in Hazelhurst. This is a little Northwoods town, kind of by Minocqua. And she moved here just last year from Southern California, and promptly won the Ms. Wisconsin pageant, and then earlier this month became Ms. America.
And what is she going to focus on as kind of her mission during her year as Ms. America?
Yes, she's been involved with diabetes education advocacy. Her father died from diabetes complications about 10 years ago, and so she's made that her mission. So we can expect, I guess, to see some public appearances or speeches on that topic from her.
Well, and Miss America is the one that's a little better known. That's the more famous competition. What's the distinction between the two?
Yeah, so I have to confess, I never knew half this stuff, but I learned from the story that, Ms. America is for women who are 26 years or older, and also you can compete even if, Judith,
yes,
you've been married or divorced even, which apparently, I guess, Miss America has to be single, which you can infer by Miss, but I think I never actually knew that.
So, Rob, let me get this straight. I could run for Ms. America?
I think you should give it a try.
All right. Well, I'm going to have to look
into
that.
You got some causes.
Well, Rob, thanks, as always, for joining us today.
All right. Thank you.
Rob Menser is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He was with us for a weekly look at state news, as he is most Fridays. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, internet companies are reacting to a bill passed last week that would make it easier to sue them for their role in sex trafficking. Big names like Google and Craigslist opposed the measure. We'll hear from a tech writer who covered the story. First, hundreds of Milwaukeeans took to the streets 50 years ago to fight for fair housing, marching from the city's north side to the south side. The Milwaukee NAACP Youth Council and its supporters marched for 200 consecutive nights between August 1967 and March 1968 to get an open housing law enacted. Now, an effort by the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and several other organizations is making sure the stories of those marchers aren't forgotten. Will Checkeritis joins us now to talk about the project. He's the Oral History Committee Chair for March on Milwaukee 50th Anniversary and a PhD candidate in history at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Will, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
How significant an event in Milwaukee history and in U.S. civil rights history were these marches?
Yeah, this is something that I think we need to remind people. Milwaukee was central to the open housing movement in America. Our NAACP Youth Council and their advisor, Father Grappi, led a series of marches for 200 days straight between 1967 and 1968. It was August to March. And they really showed a certain level of determination in working towards their cause. It was a broadly popular movement within the city's African-American communities and among their allies. But it was also a movement that saw vehement counterinsurgency and counter-protests. So it was a violent struggle in a lot of ways.
Hmm. And Will, the March on Milwaukee 50th Anniversary organization is working on collecting and documenting the stories of those original marchers. How are you doing that? How are you finding these people, first of all?
Yeah, well, let me first say that this is a really special project. It's a cross-institutional partnership between several different archives and historical organizations in the area. Kristen Leffelman at the Wisconsin Historical Society, Abby Nye and Heidi Anosko at the UW-Milwaukee Archives, Claiborne Benson at the Wisconsin Black Historical Society, Kevin Abing at the Milwaukee County Historical Society, and myself as a PhD student at UWM, we're all coming together to kind of pool resources, test our connections, and see who we can, what voices we can lift up within our community in Milwaukee that maybe haven't been heard yet.
And how are you finding those people?
So we're reaching out through different listservs around the city. Let me give you an example. Our last History Harvest, this is where we actually go out into the community and collect people's stories was held at Marquette University's Raynor Memorial Library. We tapped into listservs at retirement communities, within the Catholic Church, within Marquette University. And for this specific harvest, we were trying to gather stories from individuals within the Marquette community and the Catholic Church community, and perhaps even some white counter-protesters if they were interested, but we didn't see very much turnout on that end.
Hmm. It also seems like there are certainly some people who are still in the area after 50 years, but many, I'm sure, have moved to other parts of the state or the country. Are there any efforts to be able to reach some of those people?
Yeah, and some have even passed on, obviously.
Sure.
This was 50 years ago. Yeah, efforts have been made. And I think through social media, say Twitter or Facebook, some individuals across the country have seen that we were doing this project, and they actually reached out to the Wisconsin Historical Society, and some interviews have been conducted remotely.
Hmm. And, you know, often history is written about the big, important people. You mentioned Father Grappi, for instance, and certainly mm-hmm. a lot has been written about him. Vel Phillips was very involved in this. She, too, has gotten more recognition in the last few years. But you're really going for the everyday people. I'm sure people who would be the first to call themselves just ordinary people. As a historian yeah. and as part of this project, why is it important to talk to those everyday people?
Because these were the people on the ground really making this change happen. A lot of this organization took place away from the spotlight, outside of the halls of politics, in the basement of churches, took place in community centers with different social justice, racial justice organizations around the city. We really want to focus through this whole project more broadly in centering the voices of youth who are engaged in the struggle at this time. That includes a lot of women as well, who often do not get, are not honored quite in the same way as some of those heroic civil rights figures, mm-hmm. even at the local level, like Father Grappi.
Will Chakaritis is with us right now. He's part of the Oral History Committee for the March on Milwaukee 50th Anniversary Project. He's a PhD candidate in history at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. And Will, what is it like for you to hear these stories, to hear these memories of people who were involved in this really significant struggle 50 years ago?
Oh, it's so powerful. I mean, where to begin? I've been studying Milwaukee's civil rights history now for almost 10 years, and with each voice that we add to a project like this, I learn something new about that struggle. These are really felt emotional experiences for each individual involved, and it's touching, it's inspiring, it's energizing. I mean, part of this 200 Nights of Freedom project is to reignite this idea of protest, the idea that coming together, collectivizing, organizing, mobilizing, that this is the way that political change is really affected.
And you mentioned that one of the specific efforts is to reach out to people who were young people at the time. Do you see parallels between Milwaukee's political movements of the 1960s and political movements of today?
Oh my goodness, I do. Our second history harvest took place at the ACLU's Youth Social Justice Forum at UW-Milwaukee. And this event specifically caters to youth and youth of color in the city. And what we wanted to do was build some connections between the activism of the past and the activism that youth are doing today. And we were able to capture a lot of those stories. And you'd be amazed how much these youth actually know about this civil rights story. Hmm. I think that a lot of adults could really learn something from their experiences. They're organizing for their own struggles today that are, you know, that clearly demonstrate that a lot of the issues of the late 1960s have not been resolved.
And Will, a couple times in talking about this project, you mentioned churches and church basements and faith. How much is there a faith element to why people are saying that they became involved in this movement 50 years ago?
That's a really good question. I'm no expert in the relationship between the church and the movement, but I think there's certainly something to say for how faith-based institutions bring people together, provide a forum for people to express their humanity. And a lot of these issues around civil rights that we're discussing are, these are human issues. These are people who want their humanity to be seen, and churches provide that organizational apparatus to really affect that change that they're looking for, and also a place just to kind of share at an emotional level how they are dealing with a lot of these issues, such as housing discrimination or experiencing police brutality or experiencing education discrimination, et cetera.
Do you have a goal of how many people's memories you're hoping to record through this oral history project?
You know, we didn't set a hard number. I would say so far we have about 26 total people interviewed across three different history harvests, and then a couple more added in those remote interviews I had mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
We have over 600 minutes of interview content so far, and that includes 16 men, 10 women, and the majority of our interview subjects have been people of color.
Hmm. If someone listening has a story to tell, if they say, wow, wait, I was there, I have a story to tell, how can they get in touch with you or the committee to share that?
I'm so glad you asked that. They can reach out to me directly. My email address is tchakir2@uwm.edu.
All right. Why don't you repeat that one more time?
Sure. No problem. tchakir2@uwm.edu.
Great. And Will, as we start to wrap up, I'm sure people like me listening are anxious to know how we'll be able to hear these stories when they're put together. What's the plan for making these accessible to people?
Certainly. So we are going to gather the rest of our interviews, and we are going to index them, assign metadata, transcriptions will be done, and we're going to sort of do that work through the Wisconsin Historical Society, and then all of our partner institutions will have copies of these interviews. Mm. And that includes UWM, and I do need to give a shout out to UWM's March on Milwaukee project. Folks can visit that project, uwm.edu/March on Milwaukee. That's a great place to learn more about this history, and I'm sure that we'll connect these interviews we're collecting for this project with that project.
Well, Will, thanks so much for sharing this with us. It's a really great story and a really fascinating project.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Will Chakiritis. He's a PhD candidate in history at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He joined us to talk about a new project collecting the stories of Milwaukeeans active in the Fair Housing Marches 50 years ago. Now, you may have missed the Senate's vote last week to pass a bill called FOSTA, the Fight Online Sex Trafficking Act. The bill would make it easier to sue internet companies over their role in sex trafficking. Here's one of the bill's co-sponsors, Senator Richard Blumenthal, speaking on the floor of the Senate before the vote last week.
Websites that knowingly facilitate sex trafficking should be afforded no protection under the Communications Decency Act. They should be given no harbor or implicit approval, which is what the legislation now does.
The measure had nearly unanimous support among lawmakers, but tech companies and free speech advocates are raising alarm bells about the bill, arguing it will change the internet as we know it. The tech world is already reacting, with Craigslist suspending its personals section and other similar sites following suit. Natasha Tiku is a senior writer at Wired. She covers Silicon Valley. Natasha, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So if you log on to Craigslist right now and click on their personals section, you see a message that references this bill and says, quote, "Any tool can be misused. We can't take such risk without jeopardizing all of our other services, so we are regretfully taking Craigslist personals offline," end quote. What has been the fallout, Natasha, since the Senate passed this bill last week?
Well, some of the concerns that opponents of the bill had been voicing all along pretty quickly came to fruition, such as Craigslist taking down its personal section. Reddit also took down a number of subreddits like escorts, male escorts, sugar daddy. The problem here is that they're really concerned about the new liability that comes with the changes to legislation, and so they just don't want to take any chances, and they're taking out content that might, you know, fall under facilitating sex trafficking.
It seems like there have been other bills and other issues raised in the past that have had potential impacts on the tech industry and on internet providers, but this seems to be provoking a reaction that is much stronger and much quicker than others. What is it about this bill in particular that has the tech companies really concerned?
Sure. So one way to gauge how important it is, these changes to Section 230 of the Communications and Decency Act is to know that some people even call it the Magna Carta of the internet. This is a sacred bedrock law, you know, that's been around for more than 20 years, and it really helped the internet flourish because it offered tech companies a liability shield for user-generated content. You know, they didn't have to have the same concerns, the same legal responsibility as a publisher if they, say, moderated content on the internet. I mean, that's why this this Section 230 provision was actually added, because there was a lawsuit against a communications company called Prodigy for, you know, they made some editorial decisions about user-generated content, and then they were held liable, and, you know, legislators thought that this would kind of squash the internet, so they added this liability shield. And at the time, you know, the internet was full of promise, obviously not the same kind of backlash we've been seeing in the news recently. So so that's why they're up in arms. They're worried also that changes to Section 230 will come not only around concerns about sex trafficking, but, you know, this kind of opens the door to have some of the other critics of the tech industry start to go after this bedrock liability shield.
So Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act has been the shield that these tech companies have relied on in the past?
Exactly. Yes, it's sometimes called the Good Samaritan provision, because what it lets you do is moderate content without, you know, without being having their same responsibility of a publisher. So, for example, companies like Facebook and Google could use artificially intelligent algorithms to scan and look for potentially illegal sex trafficking without, you know, without having the responsibility of. It's just, if you do good stuff, if you try to keep bad stuff off the internet, you're fine. You're not going to be held liable.
Sex trafficking victims and their families were some of the people supporting the changes. Let's listen to Yvonne Ambrose, the mother of Desiree Robinson, who was murdered after being trafficked 2 years ago.
Desiree's death should have never happened. The sex trafficking of minors should not be happening in our country. Taking advantage of our children on the internet has become such a common thing in this country that people turn the other cheek just because they don't want to believe it's actually happening right here in our backyards.
Powerful words there from the mother of a young woman who was murdered. And Natasha, she says that people are turning a blind eye because they don't want to admit this is happening. Is this bill in part an attempt to bring that issue really front and center in a way that can't be ignored?
Yes, certainly. And actually, Yvonne's testimony was, I think, a turning point in the way supporters and opponents started talking about the bill. If you heard her speak in front of Congress, there's just, you know, kind of no way you can, you know, it's you don't want to go against somebody that has that kind of concern and is trying to make things better.
We're talking with Natasha Tiku. She's senior writer at Wired and covers Silicon Valley. And we're talking about a bill that removes liability protections that tech companies have relied on for quite a while. You said, you know, no one wants to go against that kind of testimony and that kind of sentiment. But there were individuals and groups who were against this bill. How would you categorize who the main opponents to it were?
Sure. So initially, I would say Google was one of the main opponents to the bill. They were seeking to, you know, keep Section 230 intact, and it kind of became synonymous with the tech industry and the idea that the tech industry didn't want to be regulated and didn't want to be held liable. Now, they took more of a backseat as the Russia investigation and other kinds of scrutiny from regulators started heating up. But I would say the opponents are free speech advocates, you know, free speech stalwarts, tech companies, and also more recently we've heard from sex workers who are concerned about their ability to protect themselves and to communicate online.
One of the arguments that's been made against this bill, I think, really presents an interesting situation. Basically, it sounds like this could be interpreted in a way that companies who try to do some moderation but are not moderating whatever would be considered enough are actually more in danger than companies that are not moderating, because it's the element of knowingly allowing things to go on. It seems like it would be easier in some ways to hold back and say, well, we didn't know what was going on because we weren't actually moderating. Is that one of the concerns?
Certainly. Actually, the knowing standard was a big part of the back and forth behind the scenes for this bill, because companies are worried, you know, what does that mean exactly? If I have an artificially intelligent algorithm, I'm trying to find the bad stuff and I, you know, scan something, does that mean I can be held liable because I knew it? You know, supporters for the bill point out that the knowing standard exists in other laws as well. And, you know, it will be determined by the courts and it'll work out fine. But as you can see with Craigslist and Reddit and some of those other changes, companies are concerned.
And what would good moderation look like? Is this something involving individuals who are physically reading through things? Is it looking for keywords? Is it algorithms? What kind of moderation would be needed under this bill to make tech companies safe?
Right. So they don't spell that out particularly, but I think one important context to this knowing standard is the fact that this law kind of came about because of a company called Backpage, which is an online classified site. And there were a couple cases in 2016 where people went after Backpage for underage sex trafficking. And judges dismissed the cases citing Section 230. They said, you know, because because Backpage didn't write the ads, they weren't held liable. And a Senate investigation later showed that actually they were editing a majority of their ads. If they saw words like Lolita or Amber Alert or teen, they would strip that out and then still publish the ad. So I think the authors of the bill, that's what they were more concerned about. You know, they weren't trying to promote, they weren't saying, you know, Google or Facebook is doing something inadequate. It's just, if you are knowingly facilitating it, victims should have a right to go after you. State prosecutors should be able to bring their case and not have it dismissed.
Natasha Tiku is a senior writer at Wired, where she covers Silicon Valley. She's with us today to talk about a bill passed by the Senate last week that some are saying will fundamentally change the internet as we know it. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think tech companies need to take more responsibility for the things that are done through their sites? Or do you think this bill goes too far and might end up causing censorship? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're continuing our conversation now with Natasha Tiku, a senior writer at Wired. She's talking with us about a controversial bill the Senate passed last week that some argue will change the internet that we've come to know and love. We want to know what you think. Have you been shut out from the personal section on Craigslist? Do you worry about internet companies overreacting to this bill? Or do you think it's wrong to shield tech companies from these lawsuits? Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Natasha, another group of people that were advocating against enactment of this bill were sex workers, and they're upset about a new prostitution crime that was created under this bill. What would that do?
So that adds a new crime under the Mann Act, which is a controversial piece of law in and of itself. It's called the White Slavery Act, and it creates a new charge of facilitating prostitution with reckless disregard for sex trafficking. And the standard for bringing that charge is kind of high, and that's why some of the people who were initially opposed to that ended up just, you know, letting it go. But again, as we were talking about earlier, there's an additional risk for companies. And when there's a risk, you know, companies are going to be a little bit overzealous potentially about taking off any content from their platforms, even if it's about sex workers who are just trying to, you know, communicate and protect themselves. For example, they use bad date lists to warn each other about, you know, potentially dangerous clients. And that's one big concern that that they've expressed.
As we said, this did pass overwhelmingly in the Senate, but there were two senators who voted against the bill. Who were they and what was their reason for opposing it?
Well, Ron Wyden is the person that he was the person who authored the Communications and Decency Act in Section 230, and he tried to put up a fight, a very strong fight, towards the end, but obviously didn't win. He's somebody who, you know, the tech companies had a pretty good relationship with, and he just like the tech companies used to have a lot more clout in Washington, D.C. You know, they had a cozy relationship with the Democrats, and this bill was one of the signs of them kind of losing their political power a bit.
Well, that's interesting, Natasha, because it is surprising to me. It seemed to me that tech companies spend fairly freely on encouraging legislation that they support and discouraging legislation that they don't. And I'm guessing that a lot of those 90-plus senators who voted for this have gotten tech money in the past. Do you think this is in part because of, you know, the tarnished reputation of tech in light of Russian hacking and interference and fake news promulgation?
Yes, I think so. And in terms of what they've been trying to influence, it's mostly discouraging law, not so much encouraging any legislation. So the reason I'd say it's related is because, as I mentioned earlier, you know, the tech companies were opposed to this. But around the time of Yvonne's testimony, and Facebook was facing a lot of criticism, you know, over the Russia investigation and other things, and they ended up wanting an industry group called the Internet Association. I mean, this isn't, you know, this is kind of the backroom chatter. It's not like they said this explicitly, but they wanted the Internet Association to switch their position because they just didn't need, you know, another battlefront. And that ended up changing the course of things, because when the tech industry was sort of presenting more of a united front against it, it was harder for supporters. And that ended up being a really pivotal point in the history of the bill.
Another very important issue for tech companies, not just tech companies, but they've certainly been on the forefront, is net neutrality. Do you see their seeming defeat on this issue as being something of a bellwether for where net neutrality may or may not go in the future?
I don't see it as a bellwether for net neutrality. There, you know, they also have the benefit of cable companies and lots of entrenched interests on their side. But I do see it as a bellwether for pieces of legislation like the Honest Ads Act, which was proposed also as a result of the Russia investigation, which would have companies like Google and Facebook have to put the same kind of disclosures on campaign-related ads that TV and radio and print already have to do.
And Natasha, a companion bill passed the House earlier this year. Now the measure heads to President Trump. What do we know about his stance on this? Is this something that's been on his radar as wanting to get in place?
Very recently, it has been. The White House kind of endorsed it implicitly. Ivanka Trump met with a number of victims and their families recently, so it's expected to be signed into law.
And were it to be signed into law, I mean, we've already seen, like we said, the reactions from Craigslist closing down their personal section, other tech companies responding. And that's even before it's being signed into law. If it's signed into law, what more do you expect to see happening in response?
You know, I'm not really sure. Perhaps some of the companies were responding right away in order to signal to lawmakers that they, you know, they don't feel like that knowing standard is very clear. So potentially there could be some sort of amendment that helps clarify that now that lawmakers have seen some of the responses. Although I got an interesting comment from Senator Blumenthal after Craigslist decision, and he told me if Craigslist is really trying to tell us because they can't run a page on their website without knowingly facilitating sex trafficking, that would certainly be a damning admission. So I'm not really certain what will happen, but I don't think it's, you know, certainly the status quo is not going to maintain.
Well, Natasha, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Natasha Tiku is a senior writer at Wired, where she covers Silicon Valley. She talked with us about the Senate's vote last week to pass an anti-sex trafficking law that some say would change the internet as we know it. Workplace wellness programs are on the rise. Earlier this week, WPR looked at how effective those programs are. Today, Shemaine Mills reports that the largest such program is for state employees.
Plenty of us already struggle with eating right or exercising, so it may not be surprising that lots of employees don't take advantage of workplace wellness programs. Some programs boast of having 70% or higher participation, while Wisconsin, which is offered to state and local employees, failed to muster even half that. Participation has been going up since the state started the effort in 2014, but not enough, says Deputy Insurance Commissioner J.P. Wyske.
And we haven't gotten great participation as yet. We're at about 28%. So that's something that I think that we as a state need to focus on as an employer.
The state employee health plan tries to boost participation in its workplace wellness program by offering $150. One requirement is to complete an online health survey. Sarah Bradley manages wellness initiatives for the state health program. She says before they made changes, there were complaints the online surveys were complicated and too long.
Some people couldn't tell when it ended and they felt like it went on and on and on.
Others couldn't find the website or didn't know how to log on. In an effort to make it easier for participants and control marketing, the state went with one company instead of having health insurers offer their own wellness incentives.
So with StayWell now being the single administrator, they have short and easy health survey, takes less than 10 minutes. It's available on a mobile device.
That's just the first step. Participants also have to get a health screening. And this is where some draw the line. They don't want to reveal personal health data. Bradley says a U.S. law known for short as HIPAA safeguards medical information.
It is very personal information, but it is information that's protected by HIPAA. That is one of the areas we've been trying to be more transparent in communicating with our participants, is that it is protected health information.
She says the information that's shared with the group insurance board is aggregate. No names are included or identifying characteristics. Even if people are willing to get a health screening, they may find it inconvenient to go to a location outside their office. Bradley says they're trying to change that.
If someone can go down from the office, get their blood draw, have their blood pressure checked in less than a 20-minute appointment, and within a few days go back into the portal and redeem their incentive, that's a much nicer experience for the participant than not really knowing when they've met the requirements and when their incentive's going to show up.
The incentive money is a means to an end. It's intended to give employees information about their health that will get them to act, control high blood pressure, lose weight, or tackle some other health problem. And it's unclear whether the StayWell program has saved the state money on insurance. Justin Sidner has studied wellness programs. He's an associate professor at the Wisconsin School of Business.
It really looks like using monetary incentives to kickstart habits is really not very effective for most people. The problem really doesn't boil down to that initial motivation and getting started. The problem is really finding a way to keep motivation day in and day out.
This is where the rubber meets the road, and employers are trying hard to drive workers in a healthy direction at a time obesity and weight-related diseases are on the rise. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, it's time for Mondays with Mike. WPR Director Mike Crane shares news about the network and answers your questions. That's coming up Monday right here on Central Time.